is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Tactical nuclear weapons, much in the news these last 18 months for war in Ukraine. Tactical nuclear weapons have an important history. Where we are today often is regarded as unknown territory. When it comes to tactical nukes, we've been here before, and we can look to a future where we can manage tactical nuclear weapons. However, right now there's a book that was published in 2012 that is both prescient and helpful to understand what was and what is. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News, my colleague at CBS News. He is also Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy and professor, visiting professor at Dickinson College. But right now, he's one of the authors and editors of Tactical Nuclear Weapons and NATO. Jeff, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. I begin with the history of tactical nuclear weapons. And my quick definition is low yield, short range. It gets more tactical than that. However, that's enough for this question. In 1949, Omar Bradley, a distinguished general who was one of the major figures of the Second War, regarded the tactical nuclear weapon in the U.S. arsenal as stabilizing. He believes that it was favors the defense. Stabilizing is not a word that we would associate with nuclear weapons anywhere in the world. What was the mindset in 1949. Good evening to you, Jeff.
Good evening, John. Well, in 1949, I think the mindset began with many people still thinking of nuclear weapons as just a larger form of firepower. You may recall our discussions about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and many of them thought about it in those particular terms. Second of all, by 1949, with the advent of NATO, there was a recognition that NATO, the United States and its allies, were going to be unlikely to mount sufficient conventional forces to equal what was being put forward by the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. And it was that force disparity that was thought to be destabilizing. So that's when we moved forward the decision to develop so-called tactical nuclear weapons as a firebreak, or as to make up for the difference in our shortfalls in tanks, artillery, conventional warfare, and began producing such weapons to, in fact, stabilize that particular situation.
That situation quickly descended into the Korean War. NATO imagined itself having to field 96 divisions and or use tactical nuclear weapons to secure the battlefield. I learned from your book, Jeff, that Stalin lacked, as late as 52, lacked tactical nuclear weapons. They were not part of the Soviet arsenal. So that did give an advantage to the NATO forces.
That's true. And many people saw it as a mechanism, again, to stave off that heavy armor advance that the Soviets might conduct. It's important, though, to realize what we're talking about here. As you said, limited range, limited in yield. But if one examines the Hiroshima bomb, for example, Hiroshima bomb was about 15 kiloton. Well, in our present day jargon, and even jargon or analysis back in 1949, 15 kilotons would still be considered a tactical weapon and not even a strategic weapon based on its yield, of course. Early on, the United States developed a 280 millimeter cannon, huge thing. It had to be pulled by one truck and pushed by another truck, or track vehicle rather, to get it into position. And over time, as the Soviets tried to catch up, we saw a lot of mirror imaging, I think, in the creation of these respective arsenals. The Soviets actually created a 420 millimeter self-propelled howitzer. To kind of describe what that looked like, that would be a Navy 16-inch gun on a track vehicle. Khrushchev, in his memoirs, actually wrote about this particular weapon, that it, quote, proved the smallness of the military mind. And many people believe that, by some intel reports, that when the Soviets tested it, it exploded on several occasions, killed about half the crew. So they restricted these weapons only for use in May Day parades in the 1960s and early 1970s. But as far as being really a weapon of operational utility, it had very, very little value.
Everything changed in 1953, the concept of massive retaliation. At that point, I learned the U.S. had an arsenal of 1,000 nukes. The Atomic Energy Commission that was making nuclear weapons, for heaven's sakes, Jeff, that was 10% of the budget of the federal government went into making nuclear weapons. We were manufacturing them quick. What was the vision of massive retaliation? How did that suit with a tactical nuclear weapon?
Well, this all fits into the overall scheme of deterrence. And the whole idea was that a Soviet attack anywhere would be responded with a massive response by U.S. strategic systems, if you will, holding Soviet cities as a hostage. And that would then, therefore, of course, deter that particular attack from ever coming. But over time, as we move into the later 50s and get into the 1960s, we see the Soviet Union quickly expanding its own strategic arsenal. So at the tactical level, these particular weapons were that firebreak that had a couple of then perhaps missions. One was to slow that offensive down, like I mentioned before. And number two, serve as a signal that we are now going to escalate to larger and larger weapon systems in hopes of bringing this particular conflict to a close. And finally, I think this demonstrated a certain degree of competition amongst the services. Clearly, the Air Force and the Navy had very clear missions in the area of nuclear weapons. Navy had nuclear submarines and even were putting some nuclear weapons on surface ships, nuclear torpedoes, et cetera. The Air Force, of course, had bombers, had land-based ICBMs, so they had a nuclear mission. So I think some of this was, you know, competition, the services and the Army looking for a nuclear war, and created the so-called Pentomic Division, which was based on a concept of integrating nuclear weapons at the tactical level for use in ground operations. And from that, we saw a plethora of weapons being created, tactical nuclear weapons for artillery, 155 and 8-inch in particular, the so-called Davy Crockett, which we can talk more about, my favorite, and a large number of shorter-range missiles, which were nuclear-capable, the Sergeant, the Corporal, the Honest John, and all those, I think, in some ways, was the Army seeking a nuclear role.
The 1950s and 1960s had three crises that re-examined tactical nuclear weapons. I mentioned Korea. The Korea War never concluded. Then we have Berlin, 1960-61, and the Berlin Wall, in which the Kennedy administration believed it was going to be overrun at any moment. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis, Washington was unaware, to my understanding, that Russia had deployed tactical nuclear weapons over Guantanamo. I wanted to mention to everyone who thinks that everybody was paranoid, the Russians had a battle plan to use tactical nuclear weapons to blow through West Germany and France and be in Calais in 10 days. And they had that plan all through the 60s. So what we have here is two sides staring at each other, capable of pulling a trigger. So I want to come to the way forward. 1963 to 67, flexible response. What was that, Jeff?
A flexible response was the Kennedy administration coming into office and recognizes that the Soviets had now achieved some level of parity in terms of our strategic nuclear weapons. And therefore, the whole idea that we would conduct a massive response if the Russians or Soviets were to attack us conventionally seemed to lack credibility. And so then the idea was, well, we're going to create these expanded thinking about tactical nuclear weapons. So we have a flexible response. We could still respond in a Massu style if we decided that was appropriate. We could respond at a tactical level to see if we could halt that particular offensive and perhaps reverse it. And it was this whole idea of flexible response that was important. Now, along the way, of course, these had to be integrated more and more in so-called nuclear sharing with alliances. So a large number of our allies who had similar platforms, such as the 155 howitzer or the 8-inch howitzer or some of the aircraft that we had, we would create custodial detachments whereby the Americans would maintain control of the nuclear weapons and then turn them over, if in time of a crisis, to an allied force who would actually were trained for the delivery. And we actually positioned such custodial detachments with the British Army of the Rhine in northern Germany, with the German military, with the Turks, with the Belgians, with the Dutch, who all had core sectors in West Germany as part of the defense of Germany from a Soviet attack, as well as with the Italians and the Greeks.
A near catastrophe in 1983, when the Soviet command was convinced the U.S. was going to launch a sneak attack during the Able Archer exercise of that year. Both sides were shocked at how close they came to pulling a trigger. So what we now remember as a period of perestroika or Gorbachev was a period in which the negotiators on both sides were looking to defang tactical nuclear weapons and strategic, but especially tactical, because there are thousands of them. The Soviets had at least 7,000. We didn't have a slight number at this period. So we come to the Conventional Forces Treaty of 1990, following the fall of the Soviet Union. I'll end there with the history. What did conventional forces have to do with tactical nuclear weapons after the fall of the Soviets?
Well, what it had to do with is we negotiated that, and I was heavily involved in that. And it limited several categories of military hardware on the Warsaw Pact side as well as on the NATO side. And those were tanks, artillery, armored troop carriers, combat helicopters, and attack aircraft. Well, a number of those platforms are dual capable. Again, the 155 howitzer that I'm most familiar with from my Army time, or the 8-inch howitzer, is designed primarily to deliver conventional munitions, as we see 155s doing very regularly in Ukraine right now, but also is designed to fire a nuclear weapon. So any limitation on the number of platforms, number of artillery pieces you could have in a particular designated area was also going to limit your tactical nuclear capability. Same is true for some of our tactical aircraft. And that is how these two kind of overlap, a conventional treaty, which had implications for the ability for one side or the other to deliver tactical nuclear weapons.
The Soviet Union falls, and we stop there with our history of tactical nuclear weapons, because as of the end of the Soviet Union, it appeared that the great number that were stored in the Russian side and in the NATO side were no longer necessary. We were going to work together. The ideology that had frightened America and the West for the balance of the 20th century was gone, except when we come back, the NATO posture after 92. What is Global Zero? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm speaking to Colonel Jeff McCausland, one of the authors and editors of Tactical Nuclear Weapons and NATO. I'm John Bowden.